Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 36 Senate seats will be decided this election day. We turn now not to a report on the ethics or spending on campaign ads, but other aspects of conduct expected from United States senators. Namely, what kind of hold music is permissible on the phone, how many picture frames are allotted each year, and whether or not senators may continue to get haircuts at the Senate salon once their terms are up. These are some of the rules covered in the Senate Handbook, a 380-page document of policies and regulations that was only recently made public. In addition to somewhat arcane-sounding rules governing office equipment and decor, are restrictions on gifts, flights, another use of taxpayer money. Paul Singer is politics editor at USA Today, which acquired a copy of the Senate handbook and published all but one section online. Paul Singer, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Virginia. I appreciate the invitation.
So why did USA Today go after acquiring the Senate handbook? Curiosity, or were you looking for something more specific?
We did a story a few weeks ago about members of Congress who were using taxpayer funds to travel on charter flights. And our question at that time was, is this allowable? And the answer we got from people was, well, that's governed by the Senate handbook. The rules are in the Senate handbook. And we said, okay, we'd like to see the Senate handbook so that we can compare what we know to what the rules actually spell out and to see if anybody's breaking the rules. At which point we were told, you can't have the Senate handbook. It's not public.
Well, first, what are the rules on charter flights for senators?
Well, they're detailed and specific, but the long and the short of it is you can use a charter flight when basically you can't get from here to there at any kind of other timely and commercially accessible transit. You know, obviously, senators have very busy schedules. The rules make allowance for that, and they say if necessary, because commercial transport is not available or not available within your schedule, then you can go charter, but then there's a whole series of, you know, you can't use the most expensive charter, you can only use certain types of planes, you can only, and the biggest one, you can't use it for campaign purposes. It's only for official purposes, only for official Senate business.
So I'm going to go back to the fact that this has been kept out of the public eye. Not even a copy at the Library of Congress you found at USA Today.
Right.
So how were you able to get a copy?
First of all, I feel stupid. This whole thing makes me feel dumb.
Why is that?
I've been covering congressional ethics for years, and it never occurred to me to ask for this book. I don't know.
Did you even know it existed?
I'm not sure. I mean, people had at various times sent me various bits and pieces of the rules that would govern stories I was working on at the time. But it never dawned on me to go look for the thing. And the Senate has, the Senate Ethics Committee has some stuff, has some manuals and guides on its website. The Senate Rules Committee has some stuff on its website. The House Committee has a House handbook. So it just never dawned on me to ask anybody for this thing. And then finally, you know, when we came around to this, I thought, this is ridiculous. Nobody will give me the book. So I just, you know, found a source who was, I don't think the source knew it was secret either, and they were able to provide us a copy.
What are some of the stranger, and I have to say, almost Byzantine-sounding stipulations?
It very well could have been written out of, you know, the Supreme Soviet Committee of 1935. You know, I mean, it's the Botanic Garden will make available no more than three plants for each senator's office, three plants at a time, that is, and to be maintained by the Botanic Gardens. My favorite is the sheets of paper. Each member, each senator is provided blank office paper based on a calculation, based on the population of their state, 1 1/3 sheets of paper for each adult constituent in the state. I mean, really, like, it is totally some kind of Byzantine Soviet era manual for running an organization.
There are rules about what kind of curtains you can choose. If you choose to fly a flag outside of your office, it must come in at night. There's no music allowed before 5 o'clock.
I know, I love that. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff. And of course, we were very pleased to discover that the Senate maintains a piano, which they will loan to senators for events.
Well, thank goodness you know that now. I don't know how you've been covering politics all this time without that.
And keep in mind, that means the taxpayers are paying to maintain a piano, and the taxpayers are paying somewhere for a piano tuner, because that thing gets rolled around the Capitol complex all the time.
So what are the chances that incoming senators read this?
Hopefully slim to none. My assumption is that's why they have chiefs of staff who run their offices. Now, I will say there are sections of it that will be very important. There's a whole section on incoming and outgoing senators. So, you know, if you're an incoming senator, what is your budget? How much are you allowed to use to hire people? That kind of stuff, I suspect they would at least take a glance at. But, you know, Senate offices run like small businesses, and the senator runs like a CEO, operates like a CEO. They probably are not down in these kind of weeds. They've hired chiefs of staff to manage that process for them.
As you read through some of the more, I'm going to say, inane specs in the handbook, like there's one explicitly forbidding senators from using appropriated funds for holiday cards. Mm-hmm. One can't help but wonder, you know, which senator was this rule made for?
Right. It's a really good question. You're exactly right. That is exactly what raises your eyebrows. As you see these things, they say, you know, you can't buy gifts for people with your official office account, to which the reaction ought to be, yeah, duh, of course you can't. But at some point, they decided they had to put this in writing. And it also makes you wonder, Virginia, whether that's why this thing has not been public all this time, that they just didn't want to sort of open the floodgates of questions about exactly why they have these stupid rules.
Well, and their regulations there on typewriters and microfiche, how often do you think this is actually updated?
We're talking about the U.S. Senate. It's entirely possible they still have typewriters and microfiche. Keep in mind that they don't. They're still not required to file their campaign finance reports electronically in the Senate. They can still do them on paper because, the Senate likes to maintain its prerogatives, one of which is to make this stuff as hard to access as possible. One of the reasons why this rule book has never been public is because the Senate doesn't like making things public, period, end of sentence.
Overall, Paul Singer, does looking at this Senate handbook, does it reveal anything about our country or the way our government functions for you?
What it reveals to me more than anything else is just how shy the Senate is about explaining how it operates to the American people. Because, in fact, there are extraordinarily detailed, extraordinarily Byzantine rules for almost everything. And the Senate's fear, I believe, is that once we see the rules, we will be able to ask them more questions about whether they're complying with the rules. And that is a question they don't want to answer. What the handbook tells me more than anything else is that they actually do operate with structure. They just prefer we don't know what it is.
The Black Box of the Senate with Paul Singer. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Paul Singer is politics editor at USA Today, which recently acquired and published nearly all of the 380-page Senate handbook. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org to scroll through its arcane edicts for yourself. And we move from implausible Senate rules to pure fantasy. Up next, book critic Lev Grossman explains why the turn of the millennium ushered fantasy from Nerdsville to the mainstream. We'll unleash the dragons when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There was a time not so long ago when reading fantasy lit meant you were a geek. Then Dungeons & Dragons was not played in the basement for ambiance, but because nobody wanted to admit they were doing it. But then, quietly at first, something started to change. And by 2001, a little movie called The Fellowship of the Ring broke box office records and signaled a sea change for the fantasy genre. Lev Grossman is book critic and lead technology writer for Time magazine and author of The Magician's Trilogy. He says that somewhere around the turn of the millennium, magic hit the mainstream, and he's here to explore the reasons why that might have happened. And Lev, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how would you characterize the popularity of fantasy when you were growing up in the 80s?
Well, it was certainly different. There was... I don't want to say a stigma, but I have to say a stigma because there was a stigma associated with it. It was sort of socially disadvantageous, a little bit embarrassing, a little bit infantile. I loved fantasy, and I read quite a bit of it.
In secret?
I didn't make a billboard about it. It felt as though I loved the stuff, but I felt as though that was because there was something wrong with me.
What were you reading?
I was reading, certainly T.S. Lewis and Tolkien, but also T.H. White, The Once and Future King, Piers Anthony, Anne McCaffrey, Fritz Leiber, Michael Moorcock, the sort of greatest hits, Ursula Le Guin, they keep sort of bubbling up in my memory. These were books that I was just obsessed with and read over and over again.
So you kind of put that quietly away until when? When did you begin to notice a shift that it was... that one could come out as a fantasy reader?
Well, it's quite interesting because it wasn't until much later. I would say, things began changing with Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass. A lot of adults were reading that. George R. R. Martin, it's amazing to think of it, but he published Game of Thrones in, I think, 1996.
Huh.
So a long time ago. And then, of course, Harry Potter arrived in 97. And I think it wasn't until Harry Potter started topping bestseller lists, which must have happened something like 99, that I really became conscious that that something interesting was happening. Partly it was due to the Internet. You know, when I read fantasy as a kid in the 80s, I didn't realize there were other people who are into it, whereas when you have the Internet, all those people suddenly become visible and you realize how many of them there are and that you're kind of a community. And then the Lord of the Rings movies happened. The idea that you could make a movie of the Lord of the Rings and that it would be a huge box office success would have seemed ludicrous to me in the 1980s. Then right at the turn of the millennium, it became a reality.
So the door opened a little. Maybe Harry Potter was the kind of gateway drug for a lot of people for fantasy.
I think so.
But why? Why do you think fantasy came back at that time? What would make people suddenly want to be reading about dragons and elves and magic?
You know, when you think about the reigning kind of pop culture franchises of the late 20th century, Star Wars, Star Trek, The Matrix, The X-Files, these were all science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And science fiction seemed to be the place that we turned to get the questions that we needed answering answered. And those questions seemed to be about technology and progress and how it was changing us. And around the turn of the millennium, I feel as though, this great emotional investment that we had in technology, this idea that it was going to solve problems, that computers were going to make our lives so much better. I think that idea, the bloom was off it. The Internet sort of sock bubble collapsed, and we started to think, technology is giving us things, then maybe it's taking them away, too. And I think we started to wonder, what would the world be without technology be like? Are there other ways to feel connected to the world and other people other than through a screen? And fantasy is all about those questions. Fantasy imagines, first and foremost, a world where the Industrial Revolution hasn't happened, where there's no electricity. In a way, it's very much about technology, but it's about the absence of technology. Take it away, and you get Middle Earth, you get Narnia, you get these wonderful idealized rural landscapes. And I think that started to be a place where people wanted to be.
And you note the parallel between the contemporary love of fantasy and in the 1950s, when C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien first published The Chronicles of Narnia and The Lord of the Rings. So tell us more about those parallels.
Well, I thought a lot about, why that the 50s were such a great decade for fantasy. So many people, that's when the modern fantasy novel, as we know it, really was solidified.
Mm-hmm. Also a technologically sort of advanced age.
Yes. Well, that generation, the generation that Tolkien and Lewis belonged to, their experience of the world was very strange. They were born in the late 19th century. They had these late Victorian childhoods. And then they watched the world of their childhoods com- completely disappear. They watch cities become electrified. They watch the rise of electric light, the rise of television and radio and mass media. They fought in World War I and saw the horrors of mechanized warfare. They saw horses replaced by cars. The world that they were living in the 50s looked nothing like the world of their childhoods, and they longed for that world. They felt as though they'd lost a world, a magical world, and they wrote about that, and they tried to bring that world to life in their writings. And I'm conscious that, you know, we, the generation that I'm part of, and I'm 45, we've also witnessed an enormous technological transformation. And I feel as though fantasy is a good way to ask questions about technology and what it means. I think, you know, through our investment in magic and fantasy, that's sort of what we're doing.
Well, who's asking those questions, and what kind of questions are they?
It's an interesting moment because, you know, for so much of its history, fantasy has kind of been enthralled to Lewis and Tolkien. But the people who are writing now are really innovating in ways that you haven't seen for a long time. Fantasy is changing radically. And I think that, for me, that started with George R. R. Martin, who kind of rewrote Tolkien in this wonderfully gritty, cruel, realistic, naturalistic mode. But he was followed by writers like Neil Gaiman, an American Gods, who writes about, you know, Norse gods sort of wandering the strip malls of America.
Mm, that was 2001.
Susanna Clarke, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is this wonderful sort of Jane Austen-like fantasy about wizards in the early 19th century in England. So you just have these people who are doing things with fantasy that we didn't realize could be done with it. They're making fantasy worlds that are beguiling, and you want to go to them. But they're also complex and dark in ways that Narnia and even Middle-earth weren't.
We're talking about the resurgence in fantasy literature and films that's gone on pretty much since the year 2000 with Lev Grossman. He's book critic and lead technology writer for Time magazine and author of The Magician's Trilogy. I wonder also if those kids who were sort of weaned on fantasy in the 50s and 60s, who were boomers, who grew up, shared their love of fantasy with their own kids. Do you think it may have anything to do with that?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it's certainly that's where I got my first taste. But I'm very aware that my parents were a little bit flummoxed by the fact that I continued to read fantasy as an adult. They don't. They look a little bit askance at it, and they look a little bit askance at the fact that I write fantasy. I think they think of it as for kids, but I don't, and a lot of people don't.
At the same time as this most recent resurgence of fantasy, late 1990s, 2000s, you mentioned the internet. Now, how do we know that the resurgence is driven by the consumers rather than so many content makers, so many marketers trying to follow on the heels of popular franchises like Harry Potter or Twilight, for example?
Well, you know, there's definitely a feedback loop. Once Harry Potter blew up, publishers began they began to see fantasy not as a niche. They began to look for fantasy authors. A lot more people, I think, began writing fantasy. You know, my books were published by Viking, which is a mainstream literary press. I don't think they'd ever published fantasy before, and I don't think they would have if they hadn't realized there was so much money in it. So, you know, you have a lot of people writing and reading fantasy, and the result is, you know, is this wonderful sort of moment of innovation in fantasy. You have people doing things with it that have never been done before. It's a wonderful time to be a fantasy writer and to be a fantasy reader as well.
Well, now that we all have smartphones in our pocket and have so much power, you call it magic in our pocket, do you think that this trend of fantasy, of admiring fantasy, of diving into it, is going to continue?
I think that even as technology does some of the things that we kind of associate with magic, I mean, with smartphones, you pull knowledge out of the air, you hear and see events that are happening far away. You can talk to it and tell it what to do, and it will. Even as technology kind of tries to imitate what we dream of doing with magic, you start to see how in some how sort of inadequate technology is for making us feel connected to the world and each other. You know, the mantra of the internet age is that we're all connected to each other. But I feel like a lot of people, you know, they use social media, they use Twitter and Facebook, and they realize in some ways that connects us, but in some ways it creates distance between us. And technology does as much to disconnect us as it does to connect us.
Lev Grossman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Lev Grossman is book critic and lead technology writer for Time magazine and author of The Magician's Trilogy. You can find a link to his article, How Magic Conquered Pop Culture. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to continue now with the story of Godzilla. Nope, not that one. We're talking about a 17-foot telescope residing in a cave-like trailer in Dorchester, New Hampshire. We'll let the old beast out when Word of Mouth continues after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. October is here, and it's open season for stories of ghosts and monsters. Here's one you may have heard of, Godzilla. But this one is not stomping over buildings in Japan. This Godzilla is 17 feet tall and resides in a trailer in Dorchester, New Hampshire. He comes out on new moons when the sky is at its darkest. NHPR's Sean Hurley had a late-night run-in with the 600-pound beast and brought us this story.
The boy sat in the back seat, and the two old people, his parents, sat up front.
Hey, do you remember where we're going?
We're going to see Godzilla.
The boy was going to see Godzilla, who lived at the top of a nearly treeless hill at the end of a long dirt road.
It's like we're driving over the moon.
The boy knew about the moon. Through his telescope at home, he could see its rubbled surface, the pond-like craters, and the ranging mountains. When the car stops, the boy leaps into the darkness and runs toward the looming monster and its two owners, Kevin Ackley and Barry Sawyer.
This is what we call Godzilla.
Oh my God.
Godzilla likes galaxies.
It's giant.
Godzilla is a 17-foot tall telescope, co-owned by Ackley and Barry Sawyer.
This is probably the largest scope in New England.
To look through the eyepiece, the boy will have to climb to the top of a rolling warehouse ladder.
This is the perfect night for telescopes.
But before he can look through the great telescope, the two astronomers want his eyes to get used to the dark.
Every object you can see with your unaided eyes right now is inside of our Milky Way, with the exception of what Barry showed you before, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is over here. Ready?
Yeah. Barry Sawyer fires his green laser pointer into the sky and guides the boy's eyes from star to star.
This is the great square of Pegasus. And if you come out to here and go up and right in there, you'll see a little fuzzy blob of light. That's the Great Andromeda Galaxy, and it's about as far away as most people can see. The light that left that galaxy that you're now seeing left 2 million years ago, give or take.
2.5 million.
Latest estimate, 2.5 million. I don't want to make you nervous, but it's headed toward us at 300,000 miles an hour.
Wow. After 30 minutes of sky gazing, Sawyer asked the boy if he's ready to look at Saturn in the big telescope.
You're going to walk up, pull the handrail, and put your eye right there, right in that big circle.
Oh my God, it's giant. It's actually, I can see it moving away.
Yeah, what you're actually seeing is why that's moving.
Is the orbit.
You're right. The Earth is moving. And since you're seeing such a small piece of the sky, you can actually see the Earth's movement.
Sawyer shifts the telescope so the boy can keep looking at Saturn.
I have seen things halfway across the universe. I've seen the moons of Jupiter go behind the planet. Rings of Saturn, of course, are always a wonderful sight. But mainly I go after star clusters, and they're just like sparkling jewels in the night.
The boy is shown the sparkling jewels, Comet Jacques M57, the Ring Nebula.
Oh my God.
The globular cluster M13, and the dwarf galaxy M32.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool.
As the boy is leaving, he tells Sawyer that he wants to be an astronomer when he grows up, and Sawyer gives him some advice.
Once you figure out the constellations and get a good feel for that, and you find your first two objects, your confidence builds up and you start going after fainter and fainter objects. But there's always an enjoyment in just being out and looking out into the deep night. Yeah, somewhere out there, I'd like to think a kindred spirit is looking back.
Sawyer looks up hopefully, and the boy yawns with sleep. The boy has school tomorrow and doesn't wonder about the kindred spirits. He's young enough to simply know there's someone looking back. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's something about October when wind-blown leaves skittering across the road sound more menacing, when night falls early and seems somehow blacker. It's in October that our minds turn to the eerie, the supernatural, the scary. Every culture has its stories of haunted castles and vampire lairs and sacred sites. A new book gathers some of the most puzzling enigmas and creepy landmarks from around the world. Sarah Bartlett is author of National Geographic's Guide to the World's Supernatural Places, which features more than 250 spine-chilling destinations around the globe. Sarah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be speaking to you from the other side of the world, really. So that's always a good sign.
You're in the south of France, you poor thing.
I know. I feel sorry for myself. I really do.
Well, go back to the supernatural realm. Are there certain themes or types of supernatural phenomena that we see around the world? You know, things that are, I guess, scary to everybody.
Yes, I think there. The book is made up of four or five different themes. And the most important, I think, are the haunted ones, because this seems to be the most prevalent around the world, ghosts and spirits that haunt from anywhere from Japan to the Tower of London, really. So, but there are other ones too, such as vampires seem to be quite prevalent as well after a lot of research, as are demons and the more sort of dark side of life.
Well, I'd love to delve into how different cultures interpret these stories. And let's start with those ghosts. And you mentioned a couple, the English souls and eternal unrest at the Tower of London and Japanese spirits in limbo. Tell us some ghost stories about these spirits.
Well, the Tower of London, I suppose, is easier for me because it's more my home territory. But I think because there were so many people executed or whatever in the sort of middle of the medieval period right through to the Renaissance, there's a host of very interesting stories because they're all kind of like real historical people, like Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's wife, who was beheaded because of her adultery and believed to be a bit of a witch. And also there's the story of the princes in the tower, which, of course, is a very sad story when the two boys, the sons of Edward IV, were staying there waiting for their coronation of the elder son. And suddenly they disappeared, and then Richard III took to the throne. And ever after, they found two bodies about 100 years later. And so it's these sort of spiritual footprints that people pick up on, maybe because of the history behind them, but that it's a very powerful feeling when you wander around these sort of places. So I do think that ghosts are a very important part of our culture, particularly in the West. But as you say, in the East, it's interesting too, because the Japanese, for example, have all kinds of different types of ghosts, which they give them different names. But the Yurai and I think the Onryo are different types of ghosts. And it's all dependent on what they had done in their lives that made them come back as ghosts, either as vengeful ghosts or they wanted to destroy people who had, you know, committed adultery or outstripped them in some way. Because of the culture in Japan, of course, is very different from the culture in the West.
It's interesting, the ideas of the vengeful ghost, you know, those who had been wrong. Are the images of ghosts a way to, I don't know, give us some repeated sense of justice, you know, that if we don't take care, if we don't do things correctly, ghosts will forever haunt us, or a way to just keep history with us? What do you think?
I think you're right. I think it's both, actually. I think there is this sense that the older traditions about ghosts were in a way to stop people doing wrong. You know, that's why there are a lot of mythical tales about vengeful ghosts, perhaps in Japan, in a way to sort of keep the tradition from, you know, in what we know as life, to not be unjust. But on the other hand, historically, it just seems that ghosts and spirits have always been with us, not just ghosts of vengeful spirits, but of people who want to be redeemed in some way, that they've been trapped in a time warp. You know, it's sort of, they do say that ghosts are often those who have been wronged in life, who have not passed on peacefully to the afterlife, and they're hanging on, waiting to prove something or to be redeemed or to be somehow able to move on.
Well, there's certainly a lot of witnesses to that in this book. Let's move on to vampires, which are kind of having their moment this last decade in popular culture. But when we think of them, we think of the Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, the European vampire, the good-looking white male, as in Twilight. But they take on many forms across the world. Tell us, please, about the Roma vampire legends that you discovered in Serbia.
Yes, there's some very strange ones going on, because the thing about vampire, when I started researching worldwide, because as you say, it seemed to me, well, it was all kind of centered around Dracula and the ancient myth of that sort of Romanian, Transylvanian feel. But looking further afield in the Roma people, they believe that pumpkins are vampires.
And we just found this story so interesting.
I think it's because on a full moon night out there in Serbia, where usually there's a kind of very barren landscape, and the harvest, when the pumpkins are plump, firm, and very robust, they would often take on the appearance of something very red and horrifying. And when they're actually going rotten, they start to leak a red kind of juice, mm-hmm. or blood. And so it was easy to understand why myths grew around these horrible kind of pumpkins, which would come and eat people. and they'd actually start moving around and taking over as people were trying to harvest them. It's understandable that ideas about this grew up because, you know, going out there in the dead of night and in the full moon, you do start to imagine things, especially if you live in a very kind of isolated part of the world. So, yeah, there are some very strange ones, like the vampires in Indonesia as well, which are far more notorious than I ever realized.
What do they do?
Most of them seem to be, and this is rather nasty, but they seem mostly interested in tearing out newborn babies, eating their entrails and such like. The Pontianak of Indonesia is particularly ferocious as well, because it tears off men's genitalia. And it seems to be that the vampire culture or myth, if you like, of Indonesia and the Far East is much more linked to sexuality and revenge on people who maybe have done something wrong in their sex lives. So it's a feeling that you must be very kind of pure.
We're talking about some of the witches and demons and ghosts and vampires and spirits that have haunted and terrified and fascinated people around the world with Sarah Bartlett. She's written a new guide to the world's supernatural places from National Geographic. Well, these Eastern vampires may be linked to sexuality, but also I see gender as a big part of what's going on in vampire folklore across the world. Many based on female vampires, many with women who die in childbirth and miscarry. Are these stories a way to channel grief?
I think that's another one too, yes. And I've noticed that in Well, let's say at the 19th century, which is a time when women were under a great deal of suppression in the Western part of the world. There was also the time when there was this great terrible disease, which was called consumption at the time. And people sort of wasted away and they went very pale, of course, and started coughing up blood. And there are many stories attached to these poor women, particularly, who began to waste away. Because at the time, of course, the Dracula story had become sort of well known. And so anyone who started looking as if they were, you know, dying of consumption was thought to might have been actually bitten by a vampire. And, you know, even in quite a lot in the States, there are a lot of late 19th century tales of poor women who died of consumption or in childbirth or something and were accused of being a vampire. Mm-hmm. I think there's a story about the courthouse in Manchester, Vermont, where a poor woman died and her body was dug up because they were absolutely terrified that her vital organs were still being inhabited, possessed by a vampire. And so they decided that it was time to actually burn all those internal organs and rid the village of the terrible vampire threat.
The entire village turned out to make it happen.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Absolutely extraordinary.
Well, and I think now, you know, humankind, we've seen a lot of medical advances. We now know that the consumption is not vampirism, and a lot of scientific advances as well to explain universal phenomena. So why do you think, Sarah, that we're still so drawn to the supernatural?
I think the main reason, perhaps, is that we need something other than what we see before us. It's as simple as that. Reality is so fast and furious and so sort of defined and so measured, and everything is proven, and that means it's okay or it's not okay. But anything that's mysterious or outside the natural has a tag attached to it of, well, let's try and disprove it. Let's try and do something with it. Let's try and contain it. But I think there is something that's missing in our lives. And so we are drawn to the spiritual or the supernatural or the horrific even to try and make something of the sort of ordinary lives that we live today.
Are we creating new stories? I mean, we never hear of maybe we hear of an old bed and breakfast that's said to be haunted, but you know, not a Walmart or a department store or, you know, a tech guy in Silicon Valley who transforms into a vampire at night. Are we losing these stories?
I don't think so. I think they are becoming urban legends or urban myths. And those are the sort of things that will become, if you like, bigger stories probably in 100 years' time when people have worked on them a bit. And I think also it is to do with how long something has been there. The most sacred places in the world are ones which have been around for thousands and thousands of years because there have been thousands and thousands of years worth of energy from humanity invested in that place.
Sarah Bartlett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sarah Bartlett, joining us from the south of France, no less, author of National Geographic's Guide to the World's Supernatural Places. You can see much more on the book and some of the legends and stories at wordofmouthradio.org. In contemporary America, many people are familiar with the story of Dracula.
The original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived on human blood and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula?
Well, that's not what people thought of when they heard the name Dracula until Bram Stoker's novel came out in 1897. Stoker got the name from a 15th century count in Transylvania, known for impaling his enemies on spikes. But he was no vampire. Hilary Frank brings us the story of a woman who, for the last three decades, has spent every Halloween trying to set the record straight.
There are lots of different theatrical interpretations of Dracula.
I am Dracula.
I am Dracula.
Soy Dracula.
And here's an even more obscure one.
I am Dracula.
Suzanne Muldowney performs improvisational dances of Dracula in parades, on local television shows, and at sci-fi conventions. Her signature dance is called the Dracula Archives. In it, she transforms from the real Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, to the fictional character, Dracula the Vampire. She starts out marching and lunging with a sword, and then staggers around, gasping, to show him dying in battle.
I'm lying down dead. I wake up. I'm in a daze. I'm in the twilight zone. Then I see an object on the ground. Well, it's a copy of Bram Stoker's novel. I touch it and I go through a seizure. I actually convulse. I scream. I choke. And then to illustrate that I have to consume blood to stay alive, I bite my hand. I lick my lips. Then I advance to the front of the stage as if I'm coming after somebody.
The scene ends with Suzanne bending down, as if she's preying on her victim, and making flapping bat motions with her cape. No matter what version of Dracula Suzanne's playing, real or fictional, she stays true to some text, either history books or Bram Stoker's novel.
My Dracula impersonations are authentic, and therefore they're pure.
I'm not sure it is possible to have an authentic interpretation of Dracula.
Michael Barsanti took me to the library at the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. He's the associate director. He pulled out Bram Stoker's original handwritten notes for Dracula.
Yeah, there are a couple of pages in the notes where Stoker lists various attributes and features that the vampire will have, that he can see in the dark, that he can get small or large, that no paintings that are made of him look like him. But there's no single part where he really sort of spells out, here's what Dracula should look like.
Now, if you ask Michael how Suzanne should do the real Dracula, he says she should start with a 15th century portrait of Vlad the Impaler.
In this picture, Vlad is wearing a peaked cap with a brim around the back.
I do have the red hat that's immortalized in that portrait.
You gotta have a cape, I guess.
Here we have my black cape.
She's also got the long dark hair, the tunic with Dracula's coat of arms.
Then you notice these.
What are those?
Those are green Burgundian double crosses.
Suzanne has four Dracula costumes altogether, and she sewed them herself. But there's no tux or red-lined cape.
There was a Dracula contest for which I lost by a hair to a man who was on crutches and was strictly a mock Lugosi.
It's really important to Suzanne to represent Dracula authentically, because as a kid, she resented the fact that her parents made her believe what she calls lies about fictional characters like Santa Claus. The way they talked about him, it scared her.
You better watch out. You better not cry. I'm telling you why. He's making a list and checking it twice. Who's naughty or nice? That's a threat.
That might sound like an overreaction, but the main reason Suzanne was labeled as a naughty girl is she has Asperger's disorder, which means she's more sensitive and emotional than most people. But it also means she has an incredible ability to memorize and focus. She was drawn to Dracula, at least the Dracula from Bram Stoker's novel, because
vampires were superhuman, and even if they got killed off, their legends still persisted.
And that right there, a persisting legend, is what Suzanne wants. She wants to receive prestigious awards, trophies, have her picture in the paper, evidence that she did something worthwhile. And so what if you have put all of this work into it, and one day after you die, what if people didn't remember?
Because then, if I fade into obscurity, then what happens if someone else comes along with the same idea, and I'm not going to be able to speak from the great beyond and tell them I already did that.
So you want your credit.
It's only natural.
Suzanne's interpretation, as faithful as she feels it is just that, an interpretation. One of many that have been developed over the centuries since the novel's been published. And all of those Draculas, all those undead vampires, will continue to live on long after we're gone.
And that story was produced by Hilary Frank. Thank you so much for joining us today. We hope that we've triggered at least a little bit of the Halloween spirit, Or is it too early for all of that? When do you think it's appropriate to bust out the inflatable Grim Reaper and decorative gourds? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's always the right time for Word of Mouth. So please come back for some more tomorrow too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.